Chapter 7. One morning, in the spring of 1870, a band of horse-stealing Indians raided four ranches near the mouth of Fremont Creek, on the North Platte. After scooping up horses from these ranches, they proceeded to the Fort McPherson herd, which was grazing above a post, and took about 40 government animals. Among these was my favorite little pony, Powder Face. When the alarm was given, boots and saddles was sounded. I always kept one of my best horses by me, and was ready for any surprise. The horse that I saddled that day was Buckskin Joe. As I galloped for the herd, I saw the Indians kill two of the herders. Then, circling all the horses toward the west, they disappeared over a range of hills. I hurried back to the camp and told the general that I knew where to pick up the trail. Company I, commanded by a little red-headed chap, Lieutenant Earl D. Thomas, was the first to report, mounted, at the adjutant's office. Thomas had but lately graduated from West Point. His sole instructions were, follow Cody and be off quick. As he rode away, General Emery called after him, I will support you with more troops as fast as they are saddled. The lieutenant followed me on the run to the spot, where I saw the Indians disappear. Though the Redskins had an hour and a half start on us, we followed them, on a gallop, till we could see that they had begun to drive their horses in a circle, and then in one direction after another, making the trail uncertain. It was getting dark, but I succeeded in keeping on some of the tracks. All that night the Indians endeavored, by scattering their horses, to throw us off the trail. At 3 o'clock in the morning I made up my mind that they were traveling for the headwaters of Medicine Creek, and headed straight in the direction. We found that they had reached the creek, but remained there only long enough to water their horses. Then they struck off to the southwest. I informed Lieutenant Thomas that the next water was at the springs at the head of Red Willow Creek, 35 miles away. The Indians, I said, would stop there. Thomas's men had not had time to bring so much as their coats with them. At the alarm they grabbed their sidearms and carbines and ammunition belts, and leapt into their saddles. None of us had had anything to eat since dinner the day before. In the whole outfit there was not a canteen in which to carry water. I notified Thomas that he must decide whether the troop was to undergo the terrible hardship of riding a whole day without food or water, on the chance of overtaking the Indians and getting their rations and supplies away from them. He replied that the only instructions he had received from General Emery were to follow me. I said that if it were left to me, I would follow the Indians. You have heard Cody, said Thomas to his men. Now, I would like to hear what you men think about it. Through their first sergeant they said they had followed Cody on many a long trail, and were willing to follow him to the end of this one. So the order to mount was given, and the trail was taken up. Several times that day we found the Indians had resorted to their old tactics of going in different directions. They split the herd of horses in bunches and scattered them. It was very hard to trail them at good speed. 40 hours without food and 12 hours without water, we halted for a council when darkness set in. I told Thomas that when we got within 3 miles of the springs the men could rest their horses and get a little sleep, while I pushed on ahead to look for the Indians. This was done. When we reached the spot I had designated, the saddles were removed, so that the horses could graze and roll. I rode on ahead. As I had suspected I should, I found the Indians encamped at the springs with the stock grazing around them. As quickly as possible I got back to the command with my news. The horses were quietly saddled and we proceeded, seldom speaking or making any noise. As we rode along I gave the lieutenant and first sergeant the description of the camp, and suggested that it could be best approached just at daylight. We had but 41 men. 10 of these, I said, should be detailed to take charge of the herd, while the lieutenant and I charged the camp. The Indians were encamped on a little knoll, around which was miry ground, making a cavalry charge difficult. The Indians numbered as many as we did. The safest plan was to dismount some of the men, leaving others to hold the horses, and proceed to the attack on foot. The rest of the men were to remain with their horses, and get through the marshy ground mounted, if they could. A halt was called, and this was explained to the men. It didn't take them long to understand. We approached very cautiously till we got within a quarter of a mile of the Indians. Then the charge was sounded. We did not find the land as miry as we had supposed. Dashing in among the Indians, we completely surprised them. Most of them grabbed the guns, with which they always slept, and fled to the marsh below the camp. Others ran for their horses. It was fortunate that we had dismounted 10 men. These were able to follow the Indians who had escaped to marsh. When we made the charge, my chief thought was to keep a lookout for my pony, Powder Pace. Soon I saw an Indian, mounted on him, making his escape. I rushed through the camp, shooting to the left and right, but keeping a beeline after Powder Face and his rider. Soon another Indian who was afoot leapt up behind Powder Face's rider. I knew that the little animal was very swift for a short distance, but that he would be badly handicapped by the weight of 2 men. I realized that my old Buckskin Joe was tired, but his staying qualities were such that I was sure he would overtake Powder Face, carrying double weight. Though I was not 100 yards behind the object of my pursuit, when the second Indian mounted, I was afraid to shoot. It was not yet quite daylight. I feared to fire lest I hit my beloved pony. For 2 miles I followed through the sand hills, before I dared to use my rifle. The Indian riding at the rear had a revolver with which he kept banging away, but I paid little attention to him. I knew a man shooting behind with a pistol was likely to hit nothing but air. At last I took a steady aim, while old Joe was running smoothly. The bullet not only hit the rear man, but passed through him and killed the man in front. They both fell. I took another shot to make sure they were not playing possum. As they fell, Powder Face stopped and looked around, to learn what it was all about. I called to him, and he came up to me. Both Indians were wearing beautiful war bonnets, of which I took possession, as well as of their fancy trappings. Then, taking Powder Face by the rope, I led him back to the springs, to see how the lieutenant had made out. The herd of horses was held and surrounded by a few soldiers. The rest were still popping at the Indians. But most of the redskins were either hidden among the marshes, or had got clear away to the surrounding hills. I found the lieutenant, and told him I thought we had accomplished all that was possible. The orderly sounded the recall. I have never seen a muddier set of boys than those who came out of the marsh, and began rummaging around the Indian camp. We soon discovered 200 or 300 pounds of dried meat, buffalo, deer, and antelope, also a little coffee and sugar and an old kettle and tin cups, which the Indians had used. All the men by this time had all the water they wanted. Each was chewing a piece of dried meat. Pickets were posted to prevent a surprise. Soon coffee was ready. In a short time everybody was filled up, and I told Thomas we had better be getting out of there. Many of the men began saddling the stolen horses, so as to rest their own. The lieutenant was eager to remain and rest until the reinforcements that General Emery had promised should arrive. "Your orders were to follow me, weren't they?" I asked. "Yes." "Well, then, keep on following me, and you'll soon see the reason for getting out of here." "All right," he agreed. "I've heard the general say that in a tight place your directions should always be followed." With most of the men driving the captured horses, we started for Fort McPherson. I didn't take the trail that we had followed in. I knew of a shorter route, and besides, I didn't want to meet the support that was coming. I knew the officer in command, and was sure that if he came up he would take all the glory of the capture away from Lieutenant Thomas. Naturally, I wanted all the credit for Thomas and myself as we were entitled to. The soldiers that had been sent out after us found and destroyed the village, but we did not meet them. They discovered 7 or 8 dead Indians, and there were a few more down in the marsh which they overlooked. The major in command sent out scouts to find our trail. Texas Jack, who was on this duty, returned and reported that he had found it, and that we were going back to the fort by another route. The major said, "That's another of those tricks of Cody's. He will guide Thomas back and he will get all the glory, before I can overtake him." We rode into Fort McPherson about 6 o'clock that evening. I told Thomas to make his report immediately, which he did. General Emery complimented him highly, and Thomas generously said that all he did was to obey orders and follow Cody. A report was made to General Sheridan, and the next day that officer wired Thomas his congratulations. The next day the command that was sent out after us returned to the fort. The major was hotter than a wounded coyote. He told the general that it was all my fault, and that he did not propose to be treated in any such manner by any scout, even if it were General Sheridan's pet, Buffalo Bill. He was told by the general that the less he said about the matter the better it would be for him. This was Lieutenant Thomas's first raid, and he was highly elated with its success. He hoped he would be mentioned for it in special orders, and sure enough, when the special orders came along both he and myself, together with the little command, received complimentary mention. This Thomas richly deserved, for he was a brave, energetic, and dashing officer. I gave him the 2 war bonnets I had taken from the Indians I shot from the back of Powder Face, asking that he present them to the daughters of General Augur, who were then visiting the post. Shortly after our return, another expedition was organized, with the Republican River Country as its destination. It was commanded by General Duck, a blusterer, but a jolly old fellow. The officers who knew him well said we would have a fine time, as he was very fond of hunting. He was a good fighter. It was rumored that an Indian's bullet could never hurt him. A cannonball, according to report, had hit him in the head without injuring him at all, while another cannonball, glancing off his skull, had instantly killed one of the toughest mules in the army. The Pawnee Scouts, who had been mustered out of service during the winter of 1869 and 70, were reorganized to accompany this expedition. I was glad of this. I had become very much attached to Major North, one of the officers, and to many of the Indians. Beside myself, the only white scout we had in the post at this time was John Y. Nelson, whose Indian name was Cha-Cha-Cha-Pies, or Red Willow Fill the Pipe. The man was a character. He had a squaw wife and a half-breed family. He was a good fellow, but had few equals and no superiors as a liar. With a regimental band playing The Girl I Left Behind Me, we started out from the post. A short march brought us to the head of Fox Creek, where we camped. Next morning General Duncan sent me word that I was to bring my rifle and shoot at a mark with him. I did not feel like shooting at anything except myself, for the night, before I had been interviewing the sutler's store, in company with Major Brown. When I looked for my gun, I found that I had left it behind me. I got cold consolation from Major Brown when I informed him of my loss. Then I told him that the general had sent for me to shoot a match with him, and that if the old man discovered my predicament there would be trouble. "Well, Cody," said the major, "the best thing you can do is to make some excuse, and then go and borrow a gun from one of the men. Tell the general you loan your rifle to someone for a hunt. While you are gone I will send back to the post for it." I got a gun from John Nelson, and marched to the general's headquarters, where I shot the match. It resulted in his favor. General Duck, who had never before commanded the Pawnee Scouts, confused them by posting the guards in a manner that was new to them. Furthermore, he insisted that the guards should call the hours through the night, 9 o'clock and all is well, etc., giving the numbers of their posts. Few of the scouts understood English. They were greatly troubled. Major North explained to them that when the man on the post nearest them called the hour, they must repeat the call as closely as they could. It was highly amusing to hear them do this. They would try to remember what the man on the next post had said. For example, when a white soldier called out post number 1, 9:30 and all is well, the Indians would cry out post number 5:30 cents go to H, L I don't care. So ridiculous were their efforts to repeat the calls, that the general finally gave it up and countermanded the order. One day, after an uneventful march, Major North and I went out on Prairie Dog Creek in advance of the command to kill some buffaloes. Night was approaching, and we looked about for a suitable camping place for the soldiers. Major North dismounted and was resting, while I rode down to the creek to see if there was plenty of grass in the vicinity. I found an excellent camping spot, and told North I would ride over the hill a little way, so that the advance guard might see me. This I did, and when the advance guard came in sight I dismounted, and lay down upon the grass to rest. Suddenly I heard three or four shots. In a moment Major North came dashing toward me, pursued by 8 or 10 Indians. I at once sprang to the saddle and sent several shots toward the Indians, 50 or more of whom were now in sight. Then, we turned our horses and ran. The bullets sang after us. My whip was shot from my hand, and the daylight was let through the crown of my hat. We were in close quarters, when Lieutenant Vanner, with several men, came galloping to our relief. The Indians, discovering them, rolled and fled. As soon as Major North sighted his Pawnees he began riding in a circle, which was the signal to them that there were hostile Indians in front. In an instant they broke ranks pell-mell, with the Major at their head, and went after the flying warriors. The second day, that we had been following the Indians we came upon an old squaw, who had been left on the prairie to die. Her people had built for her a little shade or lodge, and had given her some provisions, enough to last her trip to the happy hunting grounds. This is often done by the Indians, when an enemy is in pursuit and one of their number becomes too feeble to keep pace with the flight. Our scout, John Nelson, recognized this squaw, as a relative of his Indian wife. From her we learned that the Redskins we were pursuing were known as the Pawnee Killer Band. They had lately killed Buck's surveying party, consisting of 8 or 9 men. This massacre had occurred a few days before on Beaver Creek. We had found a number of surveying instruments in the abandoned camp, and knew therefore that the Indians had had a fight with white men. After driving the Indians across the Platte we returned to Fort McPherson, bringing with us the old squaw, who was sent to the Spotted Tail Agency. During my absence my wife had given birth to a son. Though he was several weeks old, when I returned no name had been given him. I called him Elmo Judson, in honor of Colonel Judson, whose pen name was Ned Budline. But the officers insisted upon calling him Kid Carson Cody and it was finally settled that this should be his name. Shortly after my return I received orders instructing me to accompany Professor Marsh on a fossil hunting expedition into the rough lands of the Bighorn Basin. The party was to consist of a number of scientists besides Professor Marsh, together with 25 students from Yale, which institution was sending out the expedition. I was to get together 35 saddle horses for the party. The quartermaster arranged for the transportation, pack mules, etc. But General Sheridan, under whose direction the scientists were proceeding, always believed in my ability to select good horses from a quartermaster's herd. In a few days Professor Marsh and his companions arrived. The Pawnee Scouts, then in camp, had a year before unearthed some immense fossil bones, so it was decided that Major North, with a few of these scouts, should also accompany the expedition. Professor Marsh had heard of this discovery, and was eager to find some of the same kind of fossils. Professor Marsh believed that the basin would be among the last of the western lands to be settled. The mountain wall which surrounded it would turn aside pioneers going to Montana or northern Oregon. These would head to the east of Bighorn Mountains, while those bound for Utah, Idaho, and California would go to the south side of the Wind River Mountains. He was confident, however, that someday the basin would be settled and developed, and that in its fertile valleys would be found the most prosperous people in the world. It was there that my interest in the great possibilities of the West was aroused. I never forgot what I heard around the campfire. In 1894 the Carey Irrigation Act was passed by Congress. 1 million acres of land was given to each of the arid states. I was the first man to receive a concession of 200,000 acres from the Wyoming State Land Board. I could not get away to the basin till late in the autumn of 1894, so I formed a partnership with George T. Beck, who proceeded to Wyoming, where he was found by Professor Elwood Meade, then in the service of the state. There's a site was located and the line of an irrigation canal was surveyed. A town was laid out along the canal, and my friends insisted upon naming it Cody. At this time there was no railroad in the Bighorn Basin, but shortly afterward the Burlington sent a spur out and from its main line, with Cody as its terminus. In 1896 I went out on a scout to locate the route of a wagon road from Cody into the Yellowstone Park. This was during Mr. McKinley's first administration. I went to Washington, saw the president, and explained to him the possibilities of a road of 80 miles, the only one entering the national park from the east. It would be, I told him, the most wonderful scenic road in the west. Mr. Roosevelt ordered the building of this road, which has now become the favorite automobile route into the park. Today the Bighorn Basin is one of the richest of American oil lands, and the Pennsylvania of the West for coal production. Every one of the prophecies that Professor Marsh made to us around that campfire has come true. In December, 1870, I was sent as a witness to Fort D.A. Russell, near the city of Cheyenne, where a court-martial was to be held. Before leaving home my wife had given me a list of articles she needed for the furnishing of our house. These I promised to purchase in Cheyenne. On arriving at Fort Russell I found many officers, also witnesses at the court-martial, and put in most of my time with them. A postponement of a week gave us an opportunity to do Cheyenne. The town furnished abundant opportunities for entertainment, as there was every kind of game in operation, from roulette to horse racing. I sent for my horse, Tall Bull, and a big race was arranged between him and a Cheyenne favorite called Green's Colt. But before Tall Bull could arrive the court-martial was over and the race was off. I sold the animal to Lieutenant Mason. I met many old friends in Cheyenne, among them R.S. Van Tassel, Tim Deere, Major Talbot, Luke Morin, Posey Wilson, and many others. They constituted a pretty wild bunch, and kept me so busy, that I had no time to think about Mrs. Cody's furniture. On my return, when she asked us for it, I told her I couldn't bring it with me on the train, and that moreover there were no stores in Cheyenne, where I could get furniture, that would be good enough for her, so I had sent to Dewey and Stone at Omaha for what she needed. I lost no time in getting over to the club, where I wrote to Dewey and Stone for all the articles my wife required. In a week the furniture arrived at Fort McPherson Station. I got a couple of 6 mule teams and went after it quick. When it arrived at the house and was unpacked Mrs. Cody was greatly delighted. About this time General Emory was very much annoyed by petty offenses in the vicinity of the post by civilians over whom he had no jurisdiction. There was no justice of the peace near the post, and he wanted some kind of an officer with authority to attend to these troublesome persons. One day he told me that I would make an excellent justice. "You compliment me too highly, General," I replied. "I don't know any more about law than a government mule knows about bookkeeping." "That doesn't make any difference," he said. "I know you will make a good squire. You accompany Mr. Whitten and Mr. Snell to North Platte in my private ambulance. They will go on your bond, and you will be appointed a justice of the peace." A number of officers from the post went to North Platte for this occasion. After I was duly sworn in, there was a celebration. I arrived home at 3 o'clock in the morning, Mrs. Cody still being in ignorance of my newly acquired honor. I was awakened by hearing her arguing with a man at the door who was asking for the squire. She was assuring him that no squire was on the premises. "Doesn't Buffalo Bill live here?" asked the man. "Yes," admitted Mrs. Cody, "but what has that got to do with it?" By this time I had dressed, and I went to the door. I informed my wife, to her amazement, that I was really a squire, and turned to the visitor to learn his business. He was a poor man, he said, on his way to Colorado. The night before, a large bunch of horses was being driven past his camp, and one of his two animals was driven off with the herd. Mounting the other, he followed and demanded the horse, but the boss of the herd refused to give it up. He wanted a writ of replevin. I asked Mrs. Cody if she could write a writ of replevin, and she said she had never heard of such a thing. I hadn't either. I asked the man in, and Mrs. Cody got breakfast for us. He refused the drink I set out for him. I felt that I needed a good deal of bracing in this writ of replevin business, so I drank his as well as mine. Then I buckled on my revolver, took down my old Lucretia rifle, and, patting her gently, said, "You will have to be constable for me today." To my wife and children, who were anxiously watching these proceedings, I said, "Don't be alarmed. I am a judge now, and I am going into action." "Come on, my friend," I said to the stranger, "get on your horse." "Why," he protested, "you have no papers to serve on the man, and you have no constable." "Don't worry," I said. "I'll soon show you that I am the whole court." I mounted Joe, and we galloped along about 10 miles, when we overtook the herd of horses. I found the boss, riding a big gray horse ahead of the herd. I ordered him to round up the herd. "By what authority?" he demanded. "Are you a constable?" I said I was not only a constable, but the whole court, and one of his men at the same time whispered to him, "Be careful, that is Buffalo Bill." At this time, as well as for years past, I had been Chief United States Detective for the Army as well as Scout and Guide. I felt that with the offices of Justice and Constable added to these titles, I had all the power necessary to take one horse. The herd boss evidently thought so, too. After asking if my name were Cody, and being told that it was, he said, "Well, there is no need of having a fuss over one horse." "No," said I, "a horse doesn't mean much to you, but it amounts to a good deal to this poor immigrant." "Well," said the herd boss, "how do you propose to settle it?" "I'm going to take you and your whole outfit to Fort McPherson. There I am going to try you and give you the limit, 6 months and a $500 fine." "I can't afford to go back to the fort," he pleaded. "Let's settle it right here." "What will you take to call it off?"
$150, I said, and quick. Reaching down into his pocket, he pulled out a wallet filled with bills and counted out $150. By this time the man who had lost the horse had caught his animal in the herd. He was standing, holding it, nearby. "Partner," I said to him, "take your horse and go back home." "Now, boss," I said to the other man, "let me give you a little advice. Be careful, when a stranger gets into your herd and the owner overtakes you and demands it. You may run into more trouble than I have given you, for you ought to know by this time, that horse stealing is a hanging offense." He said, "I didn't care a blank about your being justice of the peace and constable combined, but when I found out you were Buffalo Bill it was time to lay down my hand." "All right, old fellow," I said, "goodbye." As he rode off he called, "It was worth $150 just to get a good look at you," and the other man agreed. By the time I got back to the fort, guard mount was over, and a number of officers were in the club. When they learned how I had disposed of my first case, they told the general, who was very much pleased. "I want it noised about among the outside civilians, how you handle your court," he said. The story soon became known all over the surrounding country. Even the ladies of the post heard of it, and told my wife and sisters, too, whom I had never mentioned it. They looked upon it as a great joke.